today we're going to be in Titus chapter 1. So you want to turn there. Titus chapter 1 is a small book of the Bible. It fits on about a page and a half in my Bible. And so it's after 2 Timothy, towards the end. If you don't have a Bible, they would love to at the Welcome Center get you a Bible, either now or before you leave, to make sure you have one. But as you guys turn there to Titus chapter 1, I want to just take you back to probably an all too familiar event, an all too familiar event in your lives, in my life. I just want you to imagine with me that you're either on your phone, computer, or TV, and you're consuming news the way that you usually watch the news. So maybe it's through an app like TikTok or X, or maybe it's through some certain TV channels. I just want you to remember what that's been like, maybe the last few weeks, but really in general. And I want you to imagine with me that you're on one news channel, or you're flipping through the algorithm, and you see a post that interests you, or something on the TV that draws your attention, and you see you start to pay attention and listen to what's being said. And as you listen, you hear a very clear and somewhat compelling version of facts and truth. And so you're like, okay, sounds good. I guess that's what happened. And then you swipe and scroll or change the channel, and all of a sudden, they're talking about the same thing. There's a new person talking about the same thing, yet they seem to have conflicting facts, a conflicting version of the truth. Now, that's probably fairly familiar, and what's also probably familiar, and I'm not asking you to raise your hands, but how many of us, after experiencing that, went on a little bit of a deep dive, more of a deep dive than we probably care to commit or admit, into the rabbit hole of the internet, of whatever choice it was for you? And this happens, you know, the last few weeks, it's felt particularly like a temptation, I think, but it happens all the time. And it doesn't just happen for us, people who live in the digital age and a digital society. It happens to us as embodied humans with people we know. And it happened to Paul, it happened to Titus, it happened to the church on Crete. In fact, that's part of why Paul writes this letter to Titus. And today, we're going to read what Paul's instruction to Titus is, to instruct the church on how to deal with conflicting facts, how to deal with the temptation to dive into the rabbit hole of conspiracy, and to dive into the rabbit hole of legalism. And we're going to see what Paul's instruction is. So if you guys will turn, if you haven't already, to Titus chapter 1, we'll be in verses 10 through 16. But I want to remind us all of what this context of this letter is, what Paul is writing to. So Paul is writing to Titus, and I'm going to read verse 5 for us just to remind us. This reason, Paul says, I left you in Crete, that you should set in order the things that are lacking and appoint elders in every city as I commanded you. So Paul is writing to Titus, but this letter is not just for Titus to read devotionally or personally. It's a letter for Titus to do something with, namely to go from city to city, town to town, place to place, and establish leaders. Notice what Paul doesn't say. He could have said this, but he doesn't say this. I might have said this if I was writing Titus. He doesn't say, though, Titus, go and find the population center of Crete, buy a building, renovate it, see what you can do, and then send out information to all the cities and all the towns, and then you, Titus, alone, instruct everybody in what is true, what is right, and what is good. He doesn't say that. He could have said that. But instead, he says, go from city to city, town to town, place to place, find men of good repute, and establish them, as we talked about last week, as elders who are qualified, elders who are trained, leaders, pastors, overseers, Paul says. And so this letter was to be read by Titus, to be used to establish churches all throughout Crete, and it was to be used as he traveled to read to the church. And so, as we sit here, it's not just for pastors, elders, people who are leaders. It's for every Christian. Paul has in mind every believer in the household of faith to be listening to this, understanding this, and knowing this is what Titus is up to, this is what the elders are up to, the pastors, the overseers, and this is what I need to be. This is what I need to do to make sure that the truth of the gospel remains central to the church on the island of Crete. So I love this verse. I bring it up, one, to show the context, but two, because it's A lot of people have a life verse, and there's a lot of great life verses out there. This is my work verse, and it really is a verse for any pastor, but in particular, I get to oversee the communities, the Calvary communities of our church, the missional family of disciples that we have all throughout the city, and part of my role is to go around to find different places where there is no leader and to raise up a leader, to multiply leaders, and to make sure that there are communities of faith in every part of our city. And so I love this verse. It's helpful for us. And Paul says, this is the reason why we need to do this. He says, for, you need to establish leaders, good, sound leaders. For, verse 10, there are many insubordinate, idle talkers and deceivers. Now that probably sounds a bit familiar, right? We probably can imagine a caricature or maybe very particular people that we know, whether online or in person, that sound like this. They're insubordinate. When you confront them with truth, they don't listen. They don't really care what anybody else has to say. They just know what they had to say, so they say it no matter what. They're idle talkers. They just say whatever comes to mind, whether it's true or whether it's not, whether they know it to be true or whether they've looked into it. They're idle talkers and they're deceivers. Not only do they say things that they think maybe are true, they say things that they know. They teach things that they know are not true. And Paul hones in on one group of people that was particularly a problem on Crete. He says, especially those of the circumcision. And those of the circumcision, not a term that we probably use, probably not one that you used in the last week. And if you did, people probably looked at you funny. But it's a term that in Paul's day and from the other writings that we have of Paul's in the New Testament, we know was referring to ethnically Jewish Christians. So people who are Jewish by their ethnicity, but they're now Christians who were saying that although Christ had fulfilled the law, we still need to follow every detail of the law, including the laws of circumcision. So they were going around to Greeks and Gentiles and saying, you need to be circumcised according to the Torah and follow all that the Torah has to say. And so in our day, we may not have those people in our lives. We may not know those people. We may not be aware of anybody trying to tell us that exact thing. But we do know people of this stereotype, of this makeup. They're religious people. People who we maybe would say are overly religious. Meaning that they add things that most of us would say that's not a part of the gospel. That's not how you get saved. It's by grace alone, by faith alone. It's not through the following the Torah. Jesus fulfilled it. And in their day, they were saying they need to do this and they need to do that. You need to do the ritual hand washings and sacrifice at the temple. In our day, it might look a little bit different, but there are people in church, around church, that add things to the gospel, religious people who seem to be too religious, too intellectual for the simple truth of the gospel. The gospel seems too simple. So there needs to be more. There needs to be a deeper knowledge and a higher set of rules. And this reminds us that from Paul's day all the way till our day, the main problem, the main opponent of the church, the main form of corruption comes from within, not from the outside. In fact, the church is more hurt by corruption from within than it is from those outside of the church. And you study church history from Paul's day to up to our very time, and you know that to be true. So Paul is writing to Titus to say, this is what you need to do in the church to make sure that the simple gospel, the gospel that Jesus brought, the gospel of Jesus is taught faithfully. And this is what he says you need to do. Verse 11, just to warn you, it's going to sound a bit, it's a bit like a cultural heresy as Americans, but it's important for us. He says, verse 11, whose mouths must be stopped. In other words, these people need to be silenced. And remember the context. He's writing to Titus in the church, right? As Christians in America, we do value, right, free speech and having open dialogue with people who disagree with us and trying to win them for the gospel, having good conversations that lead to God conversations that become hopefully gospel conversations as people give their life to Jesus. Like, we want to have that. We don't want to silence everybody that disagrees. We want to talk with them and have dialogue and to grow together and to hopefully see them give their life to Jesus. But within the church, truth needs to be protected. Within the church, we need to be careful to hold to the simple truths of the Bible, the simple truths of the gospel. The church is the bastion of truth in a city. It's the place where people should know that they can step into any church gathering, whether it be a Sunday gathering at 123 Auto Drive, or a Wednesday gathering, or a Tuesday gathering in a home throughout the city. They should know that when I step into there, there's going to be a group of people who are committed to the same thing. They have the same view on life from the Bible. It says that these people need to be stopped because they subvert whole households, teaching things which they ought not for the sake of dishonest gain. And again, this probably sounds somewhat familiar. We can all think of people who teach things that we disagree with, that probably aren't true, that most likely aren't true. Maybe we actually know that they're not true. And the reason that they teach them, the reason why they peddle them, is so that they can sell something. Whether they get support for their quote-unquote ministry, whether it's to sell some product, or whether it's to get subscribers, likes, followers, they peddle falsehood, they peddle lies to get us to follow for a dishonest gain. It's one of the hallmarks of what these people, these teachers, are like. And now, why does this matter? Paul says, verse 11, who subvert whole households. It matters. This matters. Like, truth matters. These people need to be silenced because there are households that are being subverted. Now, not just like nuclear family, mom, dad, kids, households. Remember the context. Paul is writing to Titus as he travels around Crete, establishing a network of churches, a network of churches that most likely, most often met in homes. And so he's saying there are people, these teachers, deceivers, who are going into these churches, into these households of faith, and they're teaching things which are false. They're teaching things which are deceptive. They're teaching things which are insubordinate with the gospel. They're stepping into a Calvary community, and they're using the whole discussion to teach about their pet theology or conspiracy theory. And this is something that we run into from time to time, something that we help coach community leaders through, and they're great at it. They might, you know, from time to time think, oh, let me give a moment to this question. And that question becomes the question for the next 7 weeks as they continue to preach on their pet issue. These people subvert whole households. You see a community of faith, you see it nationwide, worldwide, where there's a church that starts to believe something off, slowly and surely the church drifts from the gospel. So whatever their dishonest gain was, they were subverting whole households. Maybe they had a corner on the dove market, and they knew if we get people to simply sacrifice more doves, we could make a ton of money off of this. Maybe they had the corner on the holy water, and they knew we could sell this holy water, make a killing. Whatever it was, they knew they could make money off of what they were teaching, and they're teaching it for dishonest gain and subverting the households to which they taught it. Now, Paul is going to quote one of their own, and I want us to read this in the correct way, because there's one way of reading this, and it sounds really, really harsh, and it's meant to be a little harsh, but Paul is also saying this a little bit tongue-in-cheek, so see if you can notice. It's kind of hard to pick up on, but see if you can notice the joke that he is kind of telling while also delivering a hard truth here. Verse 12. One of them, a prophet of their own, says this: Cretans are always liars. They're always liars. They never tell the truth. They're evil beasts. In fact, in their day, one of the jokes about the Cretans was that there weren't a lot of wild animals on the island, and they would joke that they didn't need wild animals because there were enough Cretans to make up for it. Enough evil beast, wild animal, Cretan people that they didn't need any of the wild animals of other islands. And then finally, he says, lazy gluttons. To which Paul says, this testimony, verse 13, is true. This Cretan, who says that Cretans never tell the truth, is actually telling the truth for once. And that's the little tongue-in-cheek right there. And it would, as Titus reads it to the Cretans, it would put them a little on their heels with a little smile on their face, probably. You got us. Yeah, we don't always tell the truth, and we are a little bit mischievous, and we do often do things for the wrong reason because we're lazy and we're gluttonous. Now, we probably wouldn't exactly as Americans line up with those things, but maybe you could say something like this about people in our day who peddle what they call truth for the wrong reasons, which is actually false. You say, well, Americans, they love the value of free speech, and so they're going to use it no matter how they can. Even if they know they're teaching things false, they're going to use their freedom of speech to do it. And Americans, they love their money. They love the capitalism. And so Americans, they're going to say whatever they want to say to make whatever money they can make because that's what Americans are like. A little harsh, right? But also a little true. As we scour the internet, as we meet people in our city, and sadly, as we even meet people in our own church, as Paul is instructing Titus to deal with, we find people who are teaching things that are false, that don't accord with the truth of the gospel for dishonest gain, according to the values of their system, the American system. Verse 13, Paul continues, says, this testimony is true. Therefore, he's going to hone in on really exactly what we should do. So silence them. But how do you silence them? Because there's a lot of ways to silence the person, some more harsh than others. What's Paul's version? He says, first, rebuke them sharply. I want to pause there because this is important. We need to hear this part. Rebuke them sharply. Dealing with heresy, dealing with lies in a church community requires sharp rebuke. Requires it. We have to be willing to have hard conversations with brothers and sisters, whether it be in a Sunday gathering, or whether it be in a community, or throughout the week in your life with believers you know. We have to be willing to be bold for the truth and to rebuke each other sharply. We have to be willing to do that. We have to be willing to know the truth and stand on the truth. We have to be willing to do that. And Paul continues, comma, that they may be sound in the faith. We have to be willing to have a hard conversation to stand firm on truth. Why? Not so people run away angry and bitter with a lot of church hurt, but so that they are sound in the faith. The word sound here is also the word for healthy. In other words, we want to confront people, rebuke them, so that they can live a healthy life with God. The goal is love. The goal is communion, community. The goal is that we would continue to be unified around the truth. And this is important. Rebuke them sharply for the right reasons. Chesterton puts it this way. He likens this to war. He's a great British pastor and writer. He says that the true soldier fights not because he hates what's in front of him, but because he loves what is behind him. In other words, we as Christians, we don't fight because we hate the person in front of us. We don't fight because of that. We don't go into the city and preach the gospel because we hate people. We don't stand in the church and have hard conversations with those that we are in community with because we hate them. No, we do it because we love what's behind us. We love the church community. We love the gospel. We love that which we are fighting for. And our hope is to not see that person lost, but to see that person won, to see that person unified with the rest of the body. Verse 14, Paul continues, and he's going to give us a little bit more information about what these false teachers were talking about, and see if you can draw any parallels to our day. Verse 14, not giving heed to Jewish fables and commandments of men who turn from the truth. So there's these Jewish fables. In our lexicon, the way that we probably would talk about this, on the streets of Boise, not giving heed to conspiracy theories, right? Not giving heed to the theories of the world that we would say that's a conspiracy theory. Isaiah said it this way in his time, just in case you think that this is a new problem as Americans where you hop online and you talk to somebody that you know at work and all they can talk about is the conspiracy around X, Y, or Z. Isaiah says this, Isaiah 8 verse 12, do not say a conspiracy concerning all that this people call a conspiracy. In other words, he's saying, do not worry about the conspiracies of this world. Do not call everything a conspiracy. He says, take things as they are, take them for fact. And I heard it said this week, and I found this really helpful. I actually had a friend share this verse with me. And another friend, they said, you know, there is one conspiracy that we should give all of our time to. You know, there are a lot of conspiracies out there that don't really matter, but there's this really great conspiracy, one that we've all heard of. And it's this conspiracy that there is this guy a couple thousand years ago who lived in the ancient Near East, and he claimed to be God, and he walked around the Sea of Galilee, different places, and he healed people. He preached this message that was really making people upset, but also bringing life to others. And he told people he was going to die. He told people he was going to bring healing and life through his resurrection, and then he died. He died. And a day passed, and he didn't rise. And they remembered he'd been stabbed through his side, where blood and water had flown out. You've been buried and wrapped in gauze and sealed in a tomb. And 2 days pass, and they sat there, and his followers, they wept and they mourned. And then on the third day, they went to visit him. And what did they find? Well, they found that what he said would happen, actually, his disciples said, they said it happened. This man named Jesus, had risen from the grave. And the conspiracy goes, not just that he rose from the grave and lived, but that he is still alive today. And this friend that pointed that out said, you know, if there's one conspiracy theory to go after, it's that one. And when you get to the bottom of understanding who Jesus was, who Jesus is, and what he did and what he's doing, then maybe you can have time to deal with a couple other conspiracy theories, but not until you figure out the whole breadth of knowledge that Jesus wants you to know. So in other words, really all our time here on earth should be spent knowing Jesus, what he did, what he's doing, and what he will do. So they're giving their time, and they're teaching these fables. And the second is that they've turned from the truth to commandments of men. In other words, to legalism. They're saying, you know, there's some secret things, some conspiracies that we want to let you in on for maybe the low cost of $5.99 a month, and we'll get you in. And they're saying, and also there's some extra rules that probably, you know, Paul and Titus, they didn't tell you about these rules because they're holding out on you. Sounds oddly familiar, right? Genesis 3, the enemy saying to Eve, some things God held out with you on, some extra things, some new things, some things that are actually beneficial for you that the church or that Paul doesn't want you to know. And so again, for the low cost of $5.99, I'll tell you what those things are. And then you can do them. And Paul says, these people, they're being the typical Cretan. They're lying. They're giving heed to the false things. They're creating new rules. And they're making it harder for people to know Jesus and harder for them to follow him. Then Paul starts to confront some of the commandments that they were teaching. In verse 15, he says, to the pure, all things are pure. With the circumcision was saying is that there's things that aren't pure. Like you can't eat all these things and you need to do things a certain way to be pure yourself. Temple rites and ritual washings and sacrifices. And Paul says, no, remember what Jesus did. Remember what Jesus did. He created clean people, pure people, people who had been purified from the inside out. And for those people, all things, everything is pure. But to those who are defiled and unbelieving, nothing is pure. But even their mind and their conscience are defiled. Now, first off, sometimes I hear this verse used in a way that's to do whatever you want to do sinfully. And this is not what Paul is saying. He's not saying that to the pure, everything is pure, even sin. So go ahead, sin all you want, and if anybody confronts you about it, just tell them that they're just not as pure as you. I've heard it used that way. It's a dangerous way to use it. What Paul is saying is that pure people, cleansed people, people who have been washed by the blood of Jesus, they choose what is good, and they are what is good as they become more and more like Christ. But to those who are defiled, he says, everything they do is bad. Remember, there are people showing up to church gatherings and teaching something that seems somewhat good, right? Like most people would say that's a good thing to do, teach the church, and it seems good, but even that good thing that they're doing, trying to quote unquote help the church, is actually a defiled thing. It's actually an evil thing. He says even their mind, the things that they're thinking about, their conscience, what they feel, even those things are out of whack. They are wrong. And so what does this mean for us? You can find people like this in all of our world. There's people who everything that they see, every conversation that you have with them, they're pointing out what's impure, what's broken, what needs to be fixed. And there's a level to that that's helpful. There's also a point where they're adding things and they're doing more and they're saying that there's an extra piece to the gospel. And so how can we tell the good from the bad? How can we tell a teacher that is teaching truth and helping the church versus a teacher that is teaching something that is deceptive and false and contrary to the gospel? One, by knowing the Bible and being able to test things based on that. But Paul gives us this great test in verse 16. He says, they profess to know God. These false teachers, they profess to know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. So right off the bat, Paul says, in works they deny him. In other words, they have this great talk, they have all these rules, but what they actually do, if you were to watch their life, doesn't even live up to what they ask of others. They say people need to do this, but they don't even do it. Their talk does not match their walk. And their life doesn't match the bar that they set for others. The second thing Paul says is they are abominable. Or if you have the NLT, it says disposable. And they live in a way that God himself looks at and says, that is revolting. And not just God, there are people that you would look at, if you saw their life and the whole of it, you'd say, no, that life, you're teaching some things that are interesting, but when I look at your life, it doesn't seem like a life that I want. It seems gross. It seems vile. It seems contrary to the way that I see that Jesus lives, the good life. And to be able to see that, we have to be able to know people personally and see their lives. Disobedient, Paul says, meaning they will not be convinced. You might try to convince them, and you might try to convince them with truth, and they won't even be convinced by clear-cut truth. They don't care. They won't submit to authority. They won't submit to Titus, to Paul. They won't submit to God. Disqualified, Paul says, for every good work. In other words, even the things that they say that they do that are good are not good. When they try to bring order to the church, they actually bring disorder. When they try to bring truth to the church, they actually bring falsehood. Now, for most of us, right, we might be able to use that on people in our lives, which is great. We know a lot of people, and this can help us as we hear something false from someone we know, we can see their life. But in our day, as we live digitally, there is a problem. A lot of us can't see the lives of those that maybe have been teaching us online. And so Paul gives us another test in Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 1, verse 4. And he says, don't give heed to fables. And this test is all about the message. How do you test the message? If you can't see the messenger, how do you test the message? Don't give heed to fables and endless genealogy, which cause disputes rather than godly edification, which is in faith. So two tests from this. Is this dispute endless? In other words, could you get to a conclusion that you could stick to? Is there some way of knowing what the answer is? Or are you bringing up your issue in the Calvary community and you talk about it week after week after week, and it's this endless thing because there's no actual way to discern whether what you are saying is true or not? We need to be people who are concerned with what the Bible is concerned with. The Bible is very clear on what the Bible is concerned with. We need to be people who care about that. And then secondly, is this discussion edifying or is it helpful? If we were to find the solution to this problem or to this debate, would anybody's life improve or would we just be kind of in the same place with no one ever helped and no one ever cared for and nothing really changing? There's disputes like that we can argue back and forth and they might be fun and they might be interesting, but in the end, we can never tell what is actually true. And even if we could, no one would be helped. And so then how do we do this as a church? Because remember, Paul is concerned about individual believers. The church was going to hear this individually. And the whole church, everyone included, all of us, would have the responsibility to test people and to keep an eye out for false teachers. But Paul is also concerned for the church doing it corporately, remember? And Titus taking care of making sure each person in the church was well cared for. So first thing is we need to copy Paul's strategy. Now, Paul's strategy here is very telling and it's very important. And it's something that we're doing our best and getting better with year by year to copy and to implement as we try to raise up leaders who can, as verse 9 says, hold fast to the faithful word as he has been taught, that he may be able by sound doctrine both to exhort and convict those who contradict. We want to raise up leaders to serve in kids ministry and youth ministry. In the area where I serve, to serve as Calvary community leaders so that there can be people in every place of our city who know truth and know how God thinks about things, know how to discern truth from falsehood, people that you can know personally and see if their life matches up to their teaching, people that can know you personally and can see the areas in which your life has gone off the rails or some way in which you've been deceived by the enemy or by the culture or by yourself. And so it's our goal to raise up more and more leaders, to raise up more people to send out, to start communities all throughout our city. And it would be cool if we had a community in every neighborhood where everyone in our church was well known and that neighborhood was well known and prayed for and people in that neighborhood knew. If I have a question about faith, if I have a question about God, I know that there's this house that every Tuesday or Sunday, or whatever day, that there's a group of people that gathers there and they study the Bible and they pray, and I know I can go ask them. I know that those neighbors care about truth, and they might be helpful in this. So Paul, he didn't remain silent. He didn't say, hey, just get away from everybody. He said, establish the right leaders over the right church. He did not succeed from the church. He could have said, you know what, Titus, let's just do our own thing. Let's not worry about it. Let's just start new churches. And he said, I'm gonna go into those places. I'm gonna do what's right. And let's go find the lost. Go find the confused and bring order. Second, we want to make sure we maintain Paul's standards. We want to make sure we maintain Paul's standards. And so as we raise up leaders, there's a temptation always, right, to raise up leaders and say, well, we need more leaders, and so we're going to lower the standards. And Paul, very clearly, last week's passage, if you didn't hear the sermon, go back and listen to it or just read it. It's very clear. The standards for leaders, people that are going to keep the church on track, are very high. They need to stay high, and we hope to only raise those standards. And so if you're somebody here who is maybe here for the first time, or maybe you've been a part of a church, been a part of our church even, and you've always had these questions and these doubts, and you've never known where to work those things out, the best place to do that, the place where you can be personally known and personally pastored by a community leader, is in a Calvary community. And then for some of us, we're strong in our faith, we know what's right, we meet the qualifications of leaders, of overseers, of elders, and the step for you might be to take a group and to continue to be a leader that you are over an increasingly sized group of that. It might be a Calvary community, it might just be some people you know, it might be coworkers, but to continue to lead. And now, I've been kind of plagued by, not really plagued by, but I've been pondering this question this last week. If we were to experience revival, I want us to all think about this. If in the next year, just imagine this, when I say revival, imagine in the next year, God brought as many people as normally come to him in 10 years, in 1 year in our city. Just imagine that. Imagine Boise goes from however many believers are in Boise, and that just multiplies by like 3 to 5. Multiplies by like 3 or 5. What would we do? The question that's plagued me is, would we actually be ready for that? I know that there's faithful men and women of our church who pray for that regularly, that God would move here in a powerful way, that their neighbors and coworkers, friends and family would flood into the church, that there would be true revival. And the question that's been haunting me all week as I read this is, would we actually be ready for that? Because when revival comes, when the move of God comes, the enemy fights back, and false teachers, deceptive thoughts and teachings arise. And so I wonder if God, through Titus, is preparing us and say, hey, just get us in order. Let's set in order the things that need to be set in order. Let's raise up leaders. By my count, like to serve our whole church, we have about 20 communities. We had 70, that would be the minimum that would actually serve our whole church. And if we had 70 and say our church doubles in size, we had those ready to multiply, we could be ready to help at least double the amount of people each week that we help and that we serve and that we pastor. And we'd be ready to make sure that as people come to faith in Jesus, they don't just come to a knowledge that they are quote unquote saved, but don't know how to live out the teachings of Jesus, but they enter into a house that's ready for them, that loves them and is ready to help them and teach them. And at the very least, even if that never happens, we simply do a better job of upholding truth and discipling people in our church. So I want us to think about that. And Paul's instruction is for all of us as we think through, as we scroll, as we talk, as we live our lives. There are people who are going to try to convince us that there's more to the gospel or less to the gospel, try to convince us that there's secret things or higher things. And Paul's instruction is for all of us, hold on to the truth of the gospel, hold on to the truth, and help others to do the same.